This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The steps the Obama administration has taken so far have not been met with much approval by environmental groups. People have not really thinking that this goes quite far enough. Now we're really just in the stage of just trying to get our minds around this, the scope of the problem.
Along with the Affordable Care Act, the Clean Power Plan may end up being one of President Obama's signature accomplishments. We learned recently, though, about the U.S. Supreme Court's potential role in determining the fate of the plan. Today on Sea Change Radio, I speak with two journalists who've been covering other aspects of the plan. First, Mother Jones journalist Tim McDonald joins us to talk about methane, a dangerous greenhouse gas that's not targeted in the Clean Power Plan or the Paris Agreement, and whose emissions from the oil and gas industry are largely unknown. We discuss the Aliso Canyon leak, efforts to monitor methane, and how much of the methane problem is cows. I then speak with Stephen Mufson from the Washington Post, who provides a who's who in the efforts to obstruct the implementation of the Clean Power Plan. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Mother Jones reporter Tim McDonald. Tim, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be here, Alex. Thanks.
So you recently wrote a piece for Mother Jones, and it's cross-published at the Climate Desk, about the U.S. methane problem. Give us the kind of the history of understanding methane, where it comes from, and what we've been doing so far to try to mitigate the problem.
Yeah, so methane is a kind of interesting character, a sort of sneaky character in the climate change story in the U.S. It accounts for a really tiny part of the U.S.'s overall greenhouse gas footprint. Only about half of 1% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. are from methane. You know, the vast majority, the other 99 or 98% is from carbon dioxide. But the impact on global warming of methane is actually amazingly severe. So methane can trap as much as 90 times more heat per molecule than carbon dioxide, especially over the short term, time periods of about 20 to 30 years. After that, it kind of degrades out of the atmosphere. So in a short time period, its impact on climate change is really severe, even more so than carbon dioxide. And this is something that scientists and policymakers have really only kind of started to grapple with over the last few years. I think before that, and even now, really, there hasn't been a ton of science done on trying to account for methane, really just trying to figure out how much is really out there. Some of the main sources that we know of are, actually the biggest one is landfills. So, gases coming off of landfills. Also agriculture, people have heard of like cow farts and cow burps as being a source. That's actually a really important one. And then also natural gas production. So basically every stage of the natural gas production system, all the way from wells to pipelines to storage facilities, processing facilities, every step along the way, there are opportunities for gas to leak into the atmosphere intentionally or accidentally. And this is a kind of the scale of the methane emissions is really something that we're just starting to grapple with. And that's what I was writing about this week was the EPA has just released this week an updated version of its greenhouse gas inventory, which is basically the official accounting of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. And it found quite shockingly that in this version of the report pegs methane emissions about 27 times higher than they had been in previous reports. And so really, in other words, the methane problem is much worse, appears to be much worse than anyone had previously appreciated.
Maybe also you could explain the difference in how methane affects what's known as the greenhouse gas inventory in terms of global warming versus carbon dioxide. We always hear about carbon dioxide, but methane is, how does it stack up in terms of apples to apples?
Yeah, so methane is about, it's a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. you know, ranging up to 90 times more potent of a greenhouse gas. In other words, capturing about 90 times, up to 90 times more heat than carbon dioxide. And that's especially true over short term, over time spans of about 20 to 30 years. So if, in terms of, you know, the U.S. being able to tackle climate change, methane is a really important thing to consider. It's a huge kind of unaccounted for part of the problem that right now at the moment, methane emissions are not regulated by the federal government. The Obama administration has taken some steps to try to change that, which I can talk about, you know, but basically this unaccounted for problem. And what we've just seen in the greenhouse, this new version of the greenhouse gas inventory that the EPA has just released, is that methane emissions are much higher than anyone previously anticipated. So this new draft of the greenhouse gas inventory raises its accounting of methane by 27 times from the oil and gas sector over what they previously estimated. So basically the point is there's a lot of methane out there and not enough is being done to control it.
I mean, 27 times. Give us a what that really means over the last couple decades.
Yeah, so the best estimate is that the kind of difference that we're talking here is basically the same climate change impact as about 200 coal-fired power plants. It's also millions of dollars worth of gas that's just lost into the atmosphere.
Or billions, I'd imagine.
Yeah, billions. Or according to the Environmental Defense Fund, it's $1.4 billion worth of lost gas in a year. So this is quite a significant impact.
And so Gina McCarthy, the head of the EPA, had said that, quote, "We've been working with the industry to try and get some voluntary efforts. Those efforts have not been as successful as they have with other industries." I wasn't really sure what she meant by that. Are we talking about voluntary efforts over the last couple years, 10 years? Can you give us kind of an idea of when the EPA started to try to get more regulations in place with the oil and gas industry and how those discussions are evolving?
Sure. So this is basically something that's kind of really unfolded during President Obama's second term in office under, you know, once the EPA has been under the administration of Gina McCarthy. The first problem, right, and this goes back to the greenhouse gas inventory, the first problem is just trying to figure out how much methane there actually is. It's not something that oil and gas producers are required to report on. And in fact, you know, even if they wanted to, it can often be quite challenging to try to identify all the different places along a natural gas pipeline or at a well or a storage facility or elsewhere that are causing leaks. Some of the things they're trying, you know, for example, they're trying to use infrared detection to try to, you know, hone in on these leaks. Because you can think about this as it's a climate change problem, obviously, but it's a problem for natural gas producers as well, because, you know, in places where gas is just leaking, that's their product just disappearing. So there's money on the table here as well. So everyone has a kind of interest in controlling the methane leak problem. It's something that, as of now, the EPA has been encouraging the oil and gas industry to do a better job of figuring out how much methane they are leaking, where it's coming from, trying to identify why, what some solutions could be. I mean, really, we're at the stage of this of just trying to get our hands around the problem at all, which is what this, you know, this new inventory estimate going up 27% just gives you a sense of, you know, the EPA is really has just been kind of slow to figure out all the places that they need to count, you know, where they need to look for leaks, how to estimate, you know, where leaks might be happening. And so this is all just kind of unfolding science.
You said 27%. I think you mean 2700%.
27 times. Yeah. 27 fold. Yeah. So this is something that they're working on now. You know, the Obama administration has proposed a new set of standards that would try to crack down on leaks in basically improving or upping the standards for new equipment to try to reduce leaks, which is a step in the right direction for addressing, you know, new gas pipeline equipment. And obviously the gas industry is booming in the U.S. There's a lot of this stuff being built. So that's good. The problem is that it doesn't address any of the existing infrastructure, which is causing the problem right now. And that's why, you know, the the steps the Obama administration has taken so far have not been met with much approval by environmental groups. People have not really thinking that this goes quite far enough. Now we're really just in the stage of just trying to get our minds around this, the scope of the problem.
I loved you good like a planet. I could have changed your heart to a star. But it all really doesn't matter at all. No, it all really doesn't matter at all. Life's a guide. Build a house on the ocean.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Mother Jones reporter Tim McDonald. So Tim, the Aliso Canyon case, was it an extreme example of methane leaking, or was it just one that got exposed?
I think it's fair to say that Aliso Canyon really is quite an extreme example. I mean, so the other really interesting study that came out this week was one of the first peer-reviewed quantitative measurements of just how much methane was really leaking from that spill. You know, listeners, you might remember that this is a leak that was happening at a natural gas storage facility outside of Los Angeles in a community called Porter Ranch. The leak first started sometime around the end of October, and it was just plugged in mid-February, just a couple weeks ago. So basically 4 months of this gas spewing at an insane volume. So this study that came out this week was trying to measure that. They had done a series of half a dozen or so flyovers in a scientific aircraft over the site over the last month or two. And what they found is that this site was leaking 60 metric tons of methane every hour that the leak was open. And just to give you a sense, that basically what they found is that this one leak of methane was doubling the methane footprint of Los Angeles every hour that it was operating. So this was a huge problem. And, you know, I think is indicative of, you know, the type of risk. I think it's almost in a way less, in some way less concerning than the broader problem, because I think this Aliso Canyon thing really was kind of it is an aberration. I mean, there's not leaks like this happening all over the world. That doesn't make it any less concerning for the people who live there. And certainly it is a problem for climate change.
And maybe it was a good wake up call for the industry in general and the regulatory agencies to try to get a hold of these other smaller methane leaks around the country.
Absolutely, certainly, and also a wake-up call for the public, I think, too, because, you know, this was a case for people to have a different perspective on a greenhouse gas that they may not be as familiar with, but is actually quite problematic.
And one of the examples that we've often heard of when we're talking about methane is cows and how much cow flatulence is producing in terms of methane. What has the livestock industry done in terms of being able to measure methane release, and is there any way to really curb that?
I think, you know, again, it's not something that's mandatory for livestock producers to report. You know, the numbers that the EPA relies on are voluntary reporting. And I think that, you know, you could probably say basically the same thing about agricultural producers as you could about the oil and gas industry, which is that, you know, they are also just sort of slowly coming to terms with this problem and trying to measure it. You know, honestly, unlike a natural gas pipeline, you know, you can't fix the leaks in the cows, so to speak. So really, you know, one of the best solutions, if this is a problem that, you know, people really want to solve, I mean, eating fewer cows is kind of at the root of the problem here. I mean, there's kind of no way to avoid, you know, a certain level of emissions from these animals if the industry is the size that it is.
Well, what do you think about the idea of having more demands on creameries and other farms that have livestock to have methane digesters? We've profiled companies on Sea Change Radio like Strauss Family Creamery, which has a methane digester, which then produces a good deal of renewable energy that can then power their own dairy.
Absolutely. I'd forgotten about that. That's a great point. Absolutely. There are definitely solutions like that. And again, it's the same thing with natural gas. The natural gas producers don't want to see their product go out the window. There's money at stake. The same is true for agriculture. You know, why not take these methane emissions and put it towards energy that you can use on your farm? And I think I would expect that a kind of comprehensive solution from a policy perspective would include incentives for things like that and other ways for the government to kind of encourage farmers to take steps like methane digesters or other cool things that scientists might be working on that I don't even know about.
So the Obama administration is probably not going to be able to get to dealing with methane emissions, you write, but you said this could be a top climate priority for a Democrat, and if a Republican wins, then forget about any curbing of methane.
Uh-huh.
What are the next kind of benchmarks that you are going to be paying attention to as a reporter to follow this issue?
You know, I think the key thing for the remainder of the Obama administration until Obama leaves office next year is to kind of pay attention to what happens with his Clean Power Plan. That's the Obama's flagship policy to address carbon dioxide emissions. This is something that is now in the court system. It's being opposed by coal producing states and some coal companies who would be obviously negatively affected by increasing standards for coal-fired power plants. That plan doesn't get to methane. I think we'll see what happens as the Clean Power Plan for carbon dioxide goes through the court system. I think the future of all of these kind of greenhouse gas and climate change initiatives really do come down to, it's sort of hard to speculate beyond who wins the White House. You know, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton's plans on these things are not very dissimilar, you know, especially when it comes to this methane problem. You know, they've basically made the same case that, you know, we should take the same standards that Obama has proposed for new infrastructure and apply those to existing infrastructure as well. So cracking down on existing pipelines, they've both gotten behind that. And as you said, you know, the Republicans have offered nothing. I mean, have not even talked about the problem at all. So I think it's just going to come down to what happens in November, I think.
Mother Jones reporter Tim McDonnell. Tim, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure, Alex. Thanks.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Stephen Mufson. He's a reporter for The Washington Post. Steve, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Glad to be here.
You recently came out with a couple pieces that outlined the Supreme Court's quote-unquote ruling, its stay against the Clean Power Plan, which was an essential part of the Obama administration's efforts to try to reduce carbon emissions. Since those articles, things have been thrown into a little bit of a tizzy, to say the least, with the passing of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. But I do want to go back to the articles that you wrote, because I think they're still germane to the general discussion of what the Clean Power Plan is and what it means for the planet, really, and global agreements like the Paris one.
Yeah, well, the Clean Power Plan's a very important building block in President Obama's climate change strategy. And that strategy has been built around regulating, sort of sector by sector, parts of the economy that he couldn't manage through cap and trade, because the cap and trade bill that passed the House back in 2009 never passed the Senate. So what the president's been doing since then is sort of going at different parts of the economy. He did it actually early, even while the cap and trade bill was still alive, by mandating higher fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. And the Clean Power Plan is something that really goes after the electricity sector and tries to reduce the amount of CO2 emissions coming from there. Those are the two big carbon dioxide emitting parts of the economy and the electric power sector accounts for at least a third or more of our greenhouse gas emissions.
One of the takeaways I had from one of your articles was basically that the market seems to be moving in the right direction for clean energy anyway, so there's not as much of a need for the clean power plan. At least that was what the Edison Electric Institute is claiming.
Yeah.
What kind of merit do you see in that claim?
I think it's very important. There are some very powerful forces that are going to keep utilities from changing course when it comes to carbon emissions. One of those forces is the fact that roughly 30 American states have renewable portfolio standards that mandate sharp increases in the amount of renewable energy that utilities rely on for generating capacity. And then the other factor, very important factor, is our market factors. The cost of solar and wind technology has been dropping at a very rapid rate. And the administration has secured an extension of tax credits for these two energy forms going out another 5 years. And they're optimistic, and I think a lot of people in industry believe, that by that time these technologies will be much more competitive with traditional energy sources such as coal.
But I couldn't help but wonder, kind of that the hanging chad, so to speak, of that statement that the Edison Electric spokesman had was, well, if that is the case, then why are 27 states and major utilities companies and these deep moneyed interests spending all this time and money to try to challenge the clean power plan through the court system?
Well, great question. And I think that part of it is that it's unclear exactly where prices will be for some of these alternative sources in 5 years. I think that utilities are extremely risk averse. They're not traditionally companies that have embraced change. Very little has changed in the utility industry until recently. So I think that they see this as it's safer to not have this hanging over their heads.
It's safer for them, at least.
Safer for them, exactly. But I do think that while pursuing these cases, I mean, not all utilities are party to these cases, but those that are still busy making preparations for what would happen if A, they lose the case, or B, the market changes even more dramatically.
It definitely evoked kind of the right-wing talking points when it came to energy innovation over the last couple decades, that let's just have the market decide and it can be an opt-in kind of thing. But it seems like the rest of the world has woken up to the idea that we don't necessarily have the luxury of letting the market decide at this point. We need lines drawn in the sand.
Yeah, I mean, even the goals set by the Obama administration or set at the Paris conference, they're very, very dramatic changes in the world of energy and utilities. But when measured against the targets that climate scientists say we need to hit in order to avert catastrophic climate change by the turn of the century, these still fall far short of what we need to get to.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Washington Post reporter Stephen Mufsin. So what do you think the other parties, the member countries that signed on to the Paris Agreement, what do they think when they see the largest polluter in the world considering the legality of something like the Clean Power Plan?
Well, I think the State Department has been in touch with quite a few people from abroad. Some the State Department reached out to, and some reached out to state to try to get a sense of how serious a setback this is for the administration. The administration's trying to say that it's not that dire. They do have a very good chance of prevailing at the appellate court division. And now that Scalia has passed away, there is a good chance that the court would deadlock 4-4, leaving an appellate court decision in place. So it may be a sort of, you know, skin of the teeth type victory in the end, but one that seems like a strong possibility at this point.
and to your credit, when you were writing this article that we're referencing here, Antonin Scalia was alive and well and on a hunting trip or something. So if he had remained alive and in his seat at the Supreme Court, that could have dragged this out quite a long way, which is one of the real problems with dealing with climate change agreements. We don't necessarily have the luxury of a 4, 5, 6 year legal battle playing out when it comes to carbon emissions.
Well, of course, the Clean Power Plan, a lot of it doesn't take, it wasn't going to take effect until 2022 anyway. So there is a little wiggle room. The stay remains in place, by the way, even though Scalia is no longer there. So there will be a delay of at least a year or so. But given that the timetable is a little slow, that might not make a huge difference.
But thinking about the utility companies, some of these investments that they have to make and into clean power can be 4 or 5 years in the making, at least, I would imagine.
That's right. And I think the issue now, as one of the people I spoke to said, is that a lot of people are going to put their pencils down for a year or so, and that would be a real delay.
But I can't let you go with that. Who said that? Jeffrey Holmsted.
Jeff Holmsted.
Tell our listeners who Jeff Holmsted is.
He was at the EPA under President Bush, and he is now a lawyer at the firm of Bracewell and Giuliani, and they represent a lot of fossil fuel industry companies.
And in 2014, a federal judge removed Holmsted as a witness, saying that his legal opinions are, quote, irrelevant, speculative, and is inadmissible, that Holmsted now seeks to change sides and testify against EPA. Mr. Holmsted should not be allowed to testify in this matter due to his multiple conflicts of interest. So he's definitely trying to play both sides of the fence, it sounds like, through his last couple decades.
He is, but I think on this particular matter, he may be in closer touch with some of those people than I might be.
I'm glad you quoted him, actually. And in fairness, I mean, you also include the executive director of the Sierra Club and Gina McCarthy from the EPA. But it must be, from your perspective, it must be very difficult to have to get two very polar opposites views and try to incorporate that into a 1,500-word piece for your paper.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of the trick day in, day out. But I did want to say one more thing about how the administration sees the Clean Power Plan, because it's true that they, I think, still believe they'll prevail in the courts. There's no question that this was a very important part of his whole climate strategy. And when they announced the Clean Power Plan, the president said it, described it this way. He said, a plan 2 years in the making and the single most important step America has ever taken in the fight against global climate change. So the administration does think this is an important part of his strategy. You know, although if they have a setback, I think they'll do what they can to work around it. And the extension of those tax credits came after the Paris meeting, and I think they're hopeful that there'll be rapid technological progress in that area, and we'll see.
He's environmental reporter Stephen Mufsin. I highly recommend reading his work at the Washington Post. Steve, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Isaac Hayes and T-Rex. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.